The Bob Murphy Show, episode 313.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Bob Murphy Show. Today I'm going to be speaking again with David Ramsey Steele. Last time he was on was to talk about his then forthcoming collection of essays. And we spent a lot of time talking about the Kennedy assassination, so you might remember that one. But now he's back. His new volume is called The Conquistador with His Pants Down, David Ramsey Steele's Legendary Lost Lectures. And so that title is coming from the title of one of the selections in the book. And what we're going to talk about in this episode that you're about to listen to is three of the essays in particular. One is on atheism, but it has to do more with like with the spirit world. And does that even make sense to say? Could things exist in a different dimension, and how would they interact with our world? That sort of thing. Then a fascinating discussion of Orwell that takes up, I think, probably most of the discussion because David is an expert on Orwell. He's written a whole book on him. And then at the tail end, we talk about his chapter on Jordan Peterson. Let me just read a little bit from the author description at the publisher website for his latest book. As an author, Dr. Steele is admired for his iconoclastic study of George Orwell's thinking in Orwell, Your Orwell, A Worldview on the Slab, 2017, praised by Yuri Maltsev as, quote, absolutely dazzling. His popular exposition of atheism, called Atheism Explained, From Folly to Philosophy, 2008, not only admired by atheists, but also frequently praised by believers for its fair-mindedness. And his demonstration of the practical impossibility of Marxian socialism in From Marx to Mises, 1992. Dr. Steele is also co-author with Michael Edelstein of 3-Minute Therapy, Change Your Thinking, Change Your Life, and Therapy Breakthrough, Why Some Psychotherapies Work Better Than Others. So without further ado, here is my discussion on various sundry topics with David Ramsey Steele. Hey folks, actually before we jump into the interview, some housekeeping from a prior episode with Sheldon Richman. I forgot to mention, and it would have been very relevant for that discussion, that his latest two books published by the Libertarian Institute are Coming to Palestine and What Social Animals Owe to Each Other. And so I have put those links back in the original Sheldon Richman episode, but if you're listening to this one with David Ramsey Steele, I also, in the show notes page here, will put links to Sheldon's books, which, of course, are very relevant to that discussion we had. Okay, so now to the David Ramsey Steele discussion. David, welcome back to the Bob Murphy Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So this time we're not talking about something nearly as interesting as the Kennedy assassination, which was what we focused on last time I think I had you on the show. But here you've got a new collection called The Conquistador with His Pants Down. So can you explain that provocative title and what the project is?
Well, just like the previous book, The Mystery of Fascism, the title of the volume takes its name from the title of one of the chapters. So the chapter on Sigmund Freud is entitled The Conquistador with His Pants Down. It's actually one of the few chapters in this book which is reprinted from an earlier publication. And that was a book which I did with Michael Edelstein called Therapy Breakthrough. Sigmund Freud wrote to his friend Wilhelm Fliess, "I'm not a scientist. I'm not an investigator. I'm a conquistador." So that's where I took that from.
And the subtitle, just for the people who haven't seen it, it says David Ramsey Steele's Legendary Lost Lectures. So what does that mean? Like, where are these coming from? Like, are these actual lectures you gave, or?
Most of the chapters in the book are based on talks I've given.
Okay.
I mean, this is actually true of most of my published articles. I usually give talks, and then they take the form of a written form and get published as a chapter or in a book or something like that.
Okay, great. So as we discussed before, I think probably to intrigue people, but also provide a good little, episode here for what we will talk about, just delving into three in particular, and then depending on the clock and how, maybe we'll talk about other things, but I think just jumping right in. So I'm looking here at selection number four called Some Second Thoughts on Atheism. And just to kind of get us going here, you've got this provocative statement: we are atheists only or mainly because we are anumatists, not the other way around. So do you want to explain that term that you coined and what you mean by that?
Yeah, this is something I've been aware of for some years, but it struck me very forcefully recently for some reason that most people who want to talk about God and argue that we need a God or there is a God or something like that, they make that the center of their belief system. But actually, it's a very subordinate element. What is much more fundamental is whether we believe in spirits. There are lots of cultures which have believed in spirits without one big boss spirit, as I call him, who created the universe. Christians and Muslims, if they're serious, are committed to the existence of billions upon billions of spirits. Do they believe that every human being is a spirit and an immortal spirit, but they also believe in angels, archangels, Nephilim, demons. There's a whole battery or army of spirits out there. So to me, as an atheist, it's fundamental that there are no spirits, and that once you agree that there are a lot of spirits, whether how they organize their own social arrangements, whether there is a big dictator who is boss of all the others, or whether they have a kind of anarchy as you might think if you believed in the Japanese folk religion, or however you think they're organized, that's a sort of very different kind of question. Where to me, it's very fundamental that there are no spirits.
Okay, so just to be clear, the title being Some Second Thoughts on Atheism, it's not that, when I was younger, I was an atheist, but now I'm seeing that's not what you mean. You mean, on second thought, it's not really the existence of a God or not that's the issue. It's the existence of spirits per se. Is that where the title's coming from?
I have to confess something here. It's an appropriate moment to confess it. I do have a mischievous streak, and it did cross my mind that people might think, Steele's come round to belief in God with that title. And then they'd start reading and they'd be disappointed.
Okay, so just to clarify for the listeners,
I'm still an atheist, but I now maintain that anumatism is more fundamental than atheism.
And for the benefit of the viewers, so anumatism is like spelled like pneumonia. So it's an A P,
In many languages, the word for spirit is the same as the word for breath, and in Greek it's pneumos, so that would give you pneumonia, but it also gives you things about the spirit world.
Yeah. Okay, so I think one way to zoom in here on how we can discuss this topic and why you're claiming that. So I think it's pretty obvious your point that where someone stands on the spirit issue is in a sense more fundamental than where's one stand on the God issue, one flows from the other. Okay, and so you say here, I deny that there are ghosts or any other kind of spirits. Why? I suppose the quickest answer is that there's no way to detect them or any of their effects. So do you want to elaborate on that?
Yes. I've actually, in my younger days, I once used to go on ghost hunts with a group of people who were looking for supernatural manifestations, and they would take. Mm. In those days, the recording equipment was they had tape recorders, and that was about it, you know. Mm. And we went to places that were supposed to be haunted, and it was like, you know, every creaking board or rattling window pane, people would say, "What's that? What's that?" You know, full of excitement that they might be stumbling upon evidence for a spirit world. But nothing happened that was ever very convincing. To me, this is a kind of parable of the human interest in the spirit world. You know, that you go to a haunted house, you set up the equipment, and the better you make the equipment, the fewer manifestations of spirits you find. And if you keep on tightening up the criteria of observation, you eventually arrive at a point where there are no really good bits of evidence for any spirit manifestation. So to me, this is the world as it is. What we call the physical world is all there is.
Okay, so if we could just dwell on that for a bit, just so I understand your position, are you open? Because I could imagine someone being like a scientific materialist, sort of a priori, just saying, no matter what I observe, I don't believe in spirits per se. I don't care what I see, what sensory data we experience. I can, you know, I would try to explain that using rational methods and not by appeal to these invisible creatures or whatever. That's just goofy talk. I'm gathering you're not saying that. You're saying, no, in principle, I would be open to evidence. I just haven't seen anything compelling.
Yes. Just to confuse and complicate matters, I also mm-hmm. maintain that if there were spirits, they would be physical. And this has been held by some mystics and religious thinkers. And it seems to me that anything that interacts with the physical world in a predictable, law-governed way must itself be physical. But that's not, you know, that's not something. I've written about this in the past, and I've argued that the whole idea of supernatural is incoherent, because if something really exists, then right. it's natural, right? So if there is a world of spirits, just like the religious people or mystics or spiritualists believe, I would think that it has to be explicable by physical laws, because it interacts with the physical world according to these people who believe in it, and it doesn't do so in a totally random manner. There are some laws governing this, and so it struck me that if you were to go back in history and say appear in ancient Egypt and tell the ancient Egyptians about the electromagnetic spectrum and the possibility of things like alpha rays, gamma rays, X-rays, and so on, they would think you were talking about a supernatural world, a spirit world. Mm-hmm. And if you were to say, no, this is science, they'd wonder what you were getting at, because it's so obviously contrary to common sense everyday experience that it seems like it must be supernatural. So I have long maintained that the idea of supernatural is incoherent. So this is just an extension of that, really.
Okay. Interestingly, we'll get to this in a minute, I think. My views are actually the mirror image of yours, I think, where I do believe like in biblical miracles, but I also think the yes. laws, it doesn't make sense to say something could have violated the laws of nature. That to me, I was saying, no, what we mean by the laws of nature are just the patterns that seem to have been obeyed when we try to look at the behavior of matter and energy. Right. And right. so by definition, if, you know, like let's say Jesus walked on water, let's say 2000 years ago, that really happened, you know, and it wasn't frozen because we right. people walk on water all the time, yes. Up in Canada. Right. So let's suppose that happened, or, you know, he raised Lazarus from the dead, or he fed 5,000 people with a few, whatever miracle, so-called miracle. And so my view is that, so I do think those things happen, but if there were scientists back then, they would have been able to figure out why. A better example, a thing where I can give more plausibility is like the plagues, like Moses is telling the Pharaoh, yeah, as people go and all those plagues hit. And so I was thinking it through one time when I was younger, and I was like, well, suppose something happened, like some chemicals were in the Nile and it made it look red, even though it wasn't literally blood. And then that would make the frogs jump out, and then the flies would follow the frogs. And then this would you know what I mean? And I just started coming up with, like, imagine if there were scientists back then that they could say, oh, no, no, this wasn't a miracle that Moses predicted. What this was, see, we can explain. And my point would just be, well, yeah, if there really were a God who created the world and everything, you could study it from the ground and it would look like that. And atoms would still be atomic and blah, blah, blah. So anyways, so I guess on, and that's, no pun intended, I was going to say in that spirit, with your perspective, is there a danger of saying that, well, gee, you know, Mr. Steele, suppose we did find something that did influence human events and, you know, people that were so-called demonic possession. And what if we really did find physical phenomena that corresponded with, you know, well-documented cases of what some priest would call demonic possession?
Yeah, well, that would certainly—
couldn't someone just say, well, that's not a spirit. That's, if it's a physical thing, by spirit, we mean it's immaterial. So no, it's not a spirit.
Demonic possession would certainly explain a lot that goes on in Washington, D.C.
So
it has that merit as an explanation, but I think there are more parsimonious explanations. I mean, one thing I should say is this. A lot of people who are atheists and materialists at this present point in the history of the culture come perilously close to denying the reality of subjective experience. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's quite ridiculous. Obviously, what we call the phenomenological world, the world of subjective experience, does exist. Now, I would say that it's an emanation, so to speak, of the physical world. In other words, if you get a brain and it's in working order and certain conditions are fulfilled, then it produces subjective experience, which is the way it seems to the conscious person who has that brain. A lot of the nonsense that we hear about artificial intelligence, the whole idea that computer programs could ever attain consciousness and think or even feel or have wishes and intentions, this is absolute nonsense. And it comes about because we're all haunted, to use a spiritualistic analogy, we're haunted by the ghost of behaviorism. This completely dotty idea that you can explain human behavior without reference to human motives and human feelings and human purposes. I think that is an error which many atheists and materialists are susceptible to.
Okay, so you've got an interesting combination.
I don't go into that in this book, though.
Right. So that's what I'd like to tease out here for a minute, because you have an interesting combination of views. Okay, so one thing I was going to ask you, and I do want to circle back to the AI stuff, but let me just first ask this. When you say, or implicit in your statement there, is, so the reason I don't believe in spirits right now is because I'm looking around and I don't see any compelling evidence that they exist. Like, what's their impact on the physical world? Mm-hmm. I don't see any. But likewise, couldn't someone say, well, I don't believe in egos. Like, I don't believe there are other minds that I just look around. No, if we zoomed in every cell in a human being's body, I could explain everything by the laws of biology. If we zoomed in even further, it's just molecules bouncing around, obeying the laws of physics. It's not that, you know, the molecules in a human body behave any differently from the molecules in a rock. And so there's nowhere for the mind to exist. It's all just billiard balls, or, you know, if you want to get quantum mechanical, whatever. So what are you talking about, a human mind? That doesn't mean anything. That's just a primitive. So you don't agree with that statement, right?
Right. I think that's a serious error.
Okay. So if we're okay saying, and, you know, the intangible human mind Because the brain and the mind are different things. And so
absolutely, yes.
If we're okay in saying it makes sense to say that there's human minds and they somehow influence the physical world, right? Like that guy chose to pick up a glass of water. So if I see someone go out and murder a bunch of people and we catch him and he's speaking in tongues and whatever and says, Satan made me do it, and a priest comes in and like, in other words, what would it look like if a spirit influenced the world, if you agree that normal minds influence the world every day?
Well, you know, I mentioned in that chapter, I do mention the possibility that we might make discoveries in the future, which would just like the whole discovery of the electromagnetic spectrum. We discovered that there was a whole world, that basically the world is chock-a-block with invisible rays of different kinds that nobody ever suspected. Furthermore, not only did nobody ever suspect it, there were no really big problems in physics which called for this as an answer. It was totally unexpected. So it's conceivable that we might find that brains, in order to produce minds, need a little help from some other entities which don't develop biologically but come from somewhere else. It's conceivable. I don't think it's particularly promising line of inquiry because there is no indication that that's the case. I mean, the way I see it is something like this. Let's suppose that you arrange some pieces of matter put them in a particular arrangement. And let's say that every time you put them in this precise arrangement, this arrangement of pieces of matter emits a blue glow, a kind of light phenomenon, right? Now, it doesn't make any sense to say, well, let's look at each component to find out where this blue glow is. You can see the blue glow. And similarly, it doesn't make any sense to look at different cells in the brain or anywhere else and say, which of these is the bit that is producing thoughts and feelings and emotions and purposes. We can see the purposes and thoughts and emotions, see metaphorically, we can perceive them just by introspection all the time. That's something that just has to be accepted. A lot of the hopes that have been vested in neuroscience are doomed to disappointment because they're all thinking that you can find an explanation for human motives that doesn't involve human motives. Mm-hmm. And, I accept that that brains produce, that they produce, phenomenological events, like thoughts, feelings, purposes, intentions. How they do it is still a mystery. Nobody has any idea, despite what they tell you. They issue promissory notes on future research because they think that we're going to get there next weekend. But actually, no real progress has been made in finding out how the brain does it. What we do know is that the only reliable events that are phenomenological are associated with a particular organ which occurs in some animals and is called a brain. Nowhere else. There is no evidence whatsoever of any thoughts, feelings, intentions, purposes that is not associated with brains. Now, maybe there are some we don't know about. We've got to be open to the possibilities. But there isn't the faintest indication that there are any such things that don't involve a brain.
Okay. Is this, let me state what I think your view is, and you tell me if I've hit it or if I'm off. So you're saying, I, David Ramsey Steele, right now, I have internal experiences of emotion, subjective desires, preferences, things like that. And so when I look at other Homo sapiens moving about in the physical world and behaving in certain ways, to me, it's a very logical hypothesis that there are other minds somehow centered in those, we don't really know exactly how it works, but that seems natural. Yeah.
It's a pretty good explanation. I think it's the best explanation.
Okay.
there are other entities with minds, and I'm not the only one. That's a pretty good conjecture.
Okay. And so then why are you just saying thus far you've seen nothing that would indicate that GPT-4 likewise has a mind internally doing that? Or like, are you saying a priori only, you know, carbon-based humanoid life forms can possibly have a mind like ours, and so therefore, in principle, I don't care what, if they build an android that acts like Data from the Star Trek series, I don't care. I'm just going to say, nope, it's just zeros and ones. That's not thinking. That's not alive.
Well, I do accept that conclusion. I can imagine circumstances that might cause me to revise it. But, two friends of mine wrote a book about a year ago. You should actually have them on your show. Jobst Landgraber and Barry Smith. They wrote a book all about this and why it is that we can't get subjective experiences out of machines. Even given another million years of human existence, which seems very unlikely given the doings of the Biden White House and such phenomena, it's never going to happen.
So let me ask one further on this, and then we can move on to other things. So it's just interesting, like I say, because I know plenty of theists, in particular Christians, who think all the hype over GPT-4 is out, but because they think, oh, humans have souls. That's what makes them special, whereas these machines are mere machines. But if you're saying you don't believe in the spirit realm and what you see is what you get, sort of, and it's the physical stuff that gives rise to the internal subjective experiences, it just seems odd that you seem like there's a pretty qualitative roadblock between, you know, a silicon-based thing becoming self-aware.
I forget the exact number of neurons in the human brain. It's something like hang on, I have to get that.
Okay.
I don't mean get it. I just mean turn it off. It's something like 100 billion neurons in the human brain, and very little is understood about their interaction. I think that it's conceivable that at some future, if the human species very improbably survives much longer, it's conceivable that scientists will be able to duplicate brain material and do things with it, and even give rise to subjective experiences in that brain material. I think it's very unlikely that. You see, it's not going to take the form of something that can be reduced to code, because what can be reduced to code is a very, very narrow slice of the mathematical world. You know, it doesn't cover much of the math of the world viewed mathematically. In other words, that complex systems cannot be predicted and cannot be exhaustively analyzed. This is just a fact of mathematics. If you read that book by Landgraber and Smith, it's explained in excruciating detail.
So things like Gödel's theorem and stuff like to show the internal limits of.
Yes, yes. Okay. I mean, but we don't even need Gödel's theorem, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I jotted that down. I will definitely follow up on that.
Yeah. The name of their book, it says it all, if I could just think of it. It's something like Why Machines Will Never Rule the World.
I've heard of that. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm jotting a note.
And I don't have as much mathematics as they do. And I was certainly not claiming that I was on the verge of discovering this myself, but I have been moving in that direction. You know, my previous collection of books, chapters it had my explanation of why we're not living in a simulation. Mm-hmm. Many of the errors that people like Scott, what's his name? Scott Adams and some of these neuroscientists and or philosophers of neuroscience, they're not real neuroscientists. Some of the things they say, you know, I take apart in that article. And so I've been moving to in this direction. And also, if you just read aspects of modern philosophy like the Chinese room debate. Mm-hmm. So I read the Chinese room debate. You know about that, you know, where
John Searle?
John Searle. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty clear that he's give a few dotting I's and crossing T's. He's basically right in what he says. So that sort of excludes a lot of nonsense that people come out with when they get intoxicated with thoughts about AI.
Well, I'm familiar with Searle's Chinese Room argument. What's interesting too is did you ever read Daniel Dennett's Consciousness Explained?
Yes, which, as everybody points out, should be Consciousness Explained Away.
Yeah, because sure.
He denies the existence of consciousness.
He calls it like a user illusion, which raises the question of who's it fooling.
That's an interesting idea that consciousness is an illusion. Because what is an illusion if not an entity, an experience, an episode in consciousness? You know, the whole thing is totally incoherent. So, and we're haunted by the ghosts of behaviorism.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, though, in that, and I have to go find it again and look it up, but I remember, you know, I read it I think I was an undergrad, if the timing makes sense. And there was a part in there where where people were talking about the Turing test. And, you know, and I was really into programming computers when I was younger. And I knew at that point, like, just how crude they were. And he had a thing saying, oh, yes, but I think he was even referring to the Chinese room or arguments along those lines. And he said, okay, but what if there were a computer program that could have a conversation with you like this? And he just went back and forth with it like a few pages in the book. And what's funny is I want to go look, because I remember at the time reading that and thinking, oh yeah, if computers could ever get to that point, that would be something. But I thought, you know, I'm not going to see that in my lifetime. And actually, I think GPT-4 has a better, quote, conversation with you than what he put in his book as an example of, oh, well, this would pass the Turing test, wouldn't it? And it's just, and the reader probably just thought, okay, yeah, but we'll never have a computer that does that. So anyway, it was just, that doesn't mean you're wrong, obviously, because you disagree with this whole framework, but I'm just saying it is interesting. I think if people look that up, they would see that what he was throwing down is clearly if the machines could ever do this, we'd have to throw in the towel that, you know, I think GPT-4 already does that.
Hey, folks, let's take a break from the action to talk about a new sponsor we have called Vita. They've created a free spam blocking and privacy tool that allows you to get rewarded for your time and attention. Here's how it works. You download their app and you select a free second phone number that's yours to keep. When someone important calls your Vita number, you'll get notified. But if it's spam, the caller will need to pay your permanent rate to get through. Try it out today by going to vita.io/Murphy. That's vida.io/Murphy. You're going to answer a question about today's episode. Then you download the app and select your free second phone number. So check it out today and start having spam callers pay you to hear their message. You go today, you get your first $1 just for downloading. Go to vita.io/Murphy to check it out. Let's get back to the show.
Okay, so let me, with the interest of time here, move on. So essay 5 in this collection is Cold Comfort for Pacifists. And so there's a little play on words there. Do you want to explain where that title's coming from?
Yes. It refers to a debate that went on in, I think, 1942. So it's in the middle of the Second World War. Or if you're British, it's in the middle of the Second World War.
Yeah.
If you're American, it's right near the beginning of the Second World War. So this was a debate between Alex Comfort and George Orwell, who at that time were not very well known. Later on, they both became extremely well known. George Orwell became extremely well known because of Animal Farm in 1984. Alex Comfort became extremely well known because of The Joy of Sex. And that was long after Orwell was dead. But in 1942, they were discussing what to do about whether to support Britain in its war against Germany that was going on at that time. Mm-hmm. And Orwell, after having been a sort of opponent of the war before it happened, but everybody knew it was coming, he switched very suddenly at the end of August 1939 and became a very, very enthusiastic supporter of the war, and spent a lot of time attacking the views that he had recently held without usually mentioning that he'd recently held those views. So it's a debate about what to do about the war between Britain and Germany. And it raises a lot of interesting issues. And one thing that struck me that I mentioned in that, it's just a review of a book about this topic, is that when people talk about issues like pacifism, they tend to leave the realm of practical politics and everyday reality and take everything to a very abstract realm where it doesn't have much practical application. And, you know, in this case, the actual circumstances were that Britain could do one of two things after the fall of France and the German occupation of Paris. Britain could have negotiated a compromise peace with Hitler and ended the war right there. Or Britain could say, no, even though we're now alone, we're going to pursue this and we're going to continue in a state of war with Germany. And of course, we all know they chose the second option. Mm-hmm. And if you look at all the circumstances, it's incredibly unlikely that anything else could have happened, actually, given the state of public opinion in Britain and so on. But it's interesting that Alex Comfort was an anarcho-pacifist. And these anarcho-pacifists, it was a very popular view among a certain group of middle-class intellectuals in the 30s and 40s. What can you say about it? They didn't want to dirty their hands with politics, and so they didn't want to advocate a negotiated peace with Hitler. But this is the only practical application you can think of what they were saying. So I just briefly look at some of the incongruities and paradoxes in the position that they took.
David, like, meaning, like, where they're coming from, like, to say, hey, we don't even think the British government should exist, and so I don't want to endorse the British government negotiating with Hitler's Germany, but we also don't want, you know, bombers going and dropping bombs on German cities. Is that the kind of thing they're saying?
Yeah. I think you can make a very good case that, especially now, because we know all about the horrors of Soviet communism as it was inflicted on half of Europe after 1945, you can make a very good case that it would have been better if Britain had negotiated a peace deal with Hitler. Now I can hear the spirit of Victoria Nuland saying, but Hitler would have continued and would have, but I don't think that's true. I think Hitler.
But you're an anumatist. No, you can't hear her spirit.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I dismissed evil spirits like Victoria Nuland.
Let me just, I read that. I noted this in your thing. So let me just read it. Buttresses what you're saying here, because I highlighted it. It says, in retrospect, with the Soviet Union enslaving half of Europe after 1945 under horrific conditions comparable to the Third Reich, the arguments for peaceful accommodation with Hitler look somewhat better today than they looked back in 1942. So I liked how you took that, you know, in many circles, and you say with respect also to some who are no longer with us, that would be a very provocative thing. You know, Mr. Steele, how can you say that, Hitler? But your point is, well, what Stalin did was not too nice either.
Right, Right, exactly.
Okay, so I think I interrupted you in midstream there. So comforts and the anarcho-pacifists, they, was it the very act of the British government negotiating and like just politics in general is like, yeah, that's icky and dirty and, you know, there's no right way to do politics. Let's just avoid it. Was that their stance?
I think so, yes. I mean, maybe some of them would say that was unfair, but it seems to me that captures an aspect of the way they thought and related to the world, mm-hmm. yes.
And now, did I catch you? Did you say Orwell originally was against British involvement in?
Oh, yes. There is another chapter in the book, I don't know if you looked at that, called The Five Times Orwell Changed His Mind.
I didn't get a chance to get into that one, no.
Okay, well, yeah, so it's very – Orwell's changes of beliefs are very interesting, mm-hmm. especially because most people get Orwell wrong because they put – there are several reasons why they do that. But part of – you know, I did write a book on Orwell, so that's – you know, I spent some years thinking about mm-hmm. this. Orwell suddenly on several occasions, and I list five of them, Orwell changed his mind quite radically and adopted a different political orientation. Mm-hmm. So the second time he changed his mind radically was in mid-1936 when he became a socialist after having been an anti-socialist. Mm-hmm. The next time he changed his mind very radically was when he was fighting in Spain. He was fighting for the left in Spain.
That's why I was so surprised by what you said, because he wrote Homage to Catalonia and he fought with the Marxists against the fascists, right?
Right. Yes.
And exactly. So that's why I would have thought he reflexively would have said, oh, yeah, war against Hitler. But apparently that's not the case.
Well, no. Well, but this is the interesting point, you see. Mm-hmm. The people who I call the revolutionary anti-Stalinist left, right, mm-hmm. Were anti-war. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I suppose it's most familiar to people as Trotskyism. But actually, the great majority of the people who took this position were not Trotskyists. But that's a more complicated thing to go into. But generally speaking, you see that first of all, you have in the Communist Manifesto, right, 1848, the working men have no country. Mm-hmm. So this is a kind of dogma of Marxism, but people who even wouldn't call themselves Marxists, but people who saw themselves as revolutionary socialists, that patriotism is a trick got up by the rich to fool okay. the poor, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so in the First World War, they got us to fight because they waved the effigy of they waved the emblem of Prussian militarism. This was a horrible thing, and we had to oppose it.
Now, in
the 30s, they're trying to do the same thing all over again. They're trying to fool us into going to war against Germany, this time saying that Nazism is a horrible thing.
Okay, right? And like, oh, and that's good for the arms manufacturers, but not for the working man.
You've got it. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the revolutionary anti-Stalinist left, including the Trotskyists, but including mm-hmm. the ILP, which was I can't explain it quickly, but it was a fairly small British political party with a rich history, which still carried a lot of weight in left-wing circles, and which was, even though small, it was actually bigger than the Communist Party, for example, the British Communist Party. So it was not totally insubstantial. The ILP mm-hmm. took this position. Some members of the ILP can be classed as Trotskyists, but most of them not. In fact, Trotsky, expressed his literary venom against the ILP and how they were doing things wrong. When Orwell, what happened to Orwell in May 1937, when he was that the communists or allies of the communists seized power in Catalonia, which is where he was near Barcelona. Actually, he was in Barcelona when this happened, 3rd of May 1937. And they suppressed the anarchists and the other people, the anti-Stalinist Marxists and so on. And Orwell was lucky to get away with it, with his life. So anyway, he became a member of the revolutionary anti-Stalinist left, and it was absolutely expected that you would be opposed to the coming war with Germany. Mm-hmm. And the usual line was that the coming war was the result of imperialism, especially British imperialism. Remember, this is when two-fifths of the Earth's land surface were colored pink on the map, showing that they belonged to Britain in the mind of the typical British troll, right?
Right.
Not literally true, of course, but anyway. So Orwell's conversion to the anti-war position and his later conversion to the pro-war position were both very, very sudden. It was sudden in the first case because he could see the skullduggery the communists were doing in mm-hmm. Barcelona. And one thing then never changed for the rest of Orwell's life. He became a very bitter anti-communist. That dates from May 1937. And when he got back to England, he found that the communist line on what had happened in Barcelona was being accepted, not just by communist publications, but by most publications, most newspapers. Mm-hmm. And it was a completely mendacious account of what had happened. So then...
If I could just jump in for a second, because, I remember reading in Homage to Catalonia how, I'm getting the details wrong, but like he and his comrades were out there fighting, and then the Marxists sitting back in the cafes writing up newsletters were just lying about these cowards on the front line, traitors, and he was just outraged, and like that was very eye-opening to him about what monsters these people were.
Yeah, and of course, Orwell was among the Marxists as well, although Orwell always said he wasn't a Marxist, but he was actually fighting with a small political party that was only had any members at all to speak of in Barcelona. So anyway, I don't want to get into too complicated in this brief interview. But what happened then was that first of all, Orwell joined the ILP and explained why he had joined the ILP. And he was so anti-war. This was a coming expected war. He was so anti-war that he wrote to some friends saying, "We've got to have an illegal underground operation to sabotage the war when it starts." So he was very, very anti-war. And then suddenly, and this would be August 22nd, I think it was. Maybe a few days off, August 22nd, 1939, he had this sounds incredible, but this is his own account, right? Mm-hmm. He had a dream. And he woke up from this dream, and he doesn't say exactly what had happened in the dream, except that the war had started. He knew, because of this dream, that he would support Britain, or as he always said, England, because he was really an old-fashioned kind of English person, that he would support Britain in the war against Germany. And he made it sound in that account as though it was like a burst of patriotism from out of the blue. But actually, there's evidence that he'd been accumulating doubts about the anti-war position for some time. Mm-hmm. So he had this dream. He suddenly switched, if you believe his account, which I do, he switched from being anti-war to being pro-war in a few minutes on waking. Mm-hmm. He came downstairs and saw the headlines in the newspapers, and it was Ribbentrop's visit to Moscow. And everybody who was politically attuned knew what that meant. It meant there was going to be an alliance of peace and friendship between the Soviet Union and the Third Reich. And that the communist parties of the world were suddenly going to become the peace parties, opposing this war against Hitler and propagandizing for acceptance of Hitler's peace terms, because Hitler kept on saying he wanted to make peace with the British Empire, which he very much admired and didn't want to destroy. So that was a well-known sort of fact of the diplomatic situation. So anyway, so Orwell then, from then on, became ferociously pro-war and really nasty in his attack on, you know, hinting that people who were opposed to the war were homosexuals and therefore cowards. Because, you know, one of the things about Orwell, which is explored in my book a little, is that he had this very firm belief that things like homosexuality and even birth control were signs of decadent industrial capitalism. Not that he was personally upset by homosexuality or anything like that. He had friends who were homosexual. But he thought that as a matter of high principle, it's something to be opposed. Having become a real fanatical pro-war person, he got a job with the BBC, and this was the period where from the beginning of the war until, let's say, June 22nd, 1941, which you know what that means if you're Russian. It means the beginning of the great of the well. It means Operation Barbarossa, which is the beginning of the Great Patriotic War. Then there is a slight dissonance between Orwell, but that period in between those two dates was the period when he was most totally at home with the major segment of the British left, when they were all pro-war and socialists. And of course, after he'd become very pro-war, Orwell took the view that the only way that this war could be won was by having a socialist revolution in Britain. And he would actually say every time there was a German victory, and there were quite a few of those early on, he would say this is because they have socialism. Socialism will always beat capitalism in a war. I mean, this is a ridiculous position to take, of course, but I'm leaving aside my own reaction to it. This was his view that Germany is bound to win unless we can get a socialist revolution going in Britain, because a socialist country will always beat a capitalist country in a war because it's so much more efficient, because everything's planned.
They use their resources more effectively. They don't have a bunch of advertising budgets they're wasting where they're building tanks and whatever. Okay.
Right.
That's interesting. Because, of course, as you well know, Mises said the exact opposite, that no capitalist country's ever lost. And the only reason the Soviets did so well against the Nazis was because of Lend-Lease and all that stuff.
Well, the Soviets did get a lot of help from people like Alger Hiss, who were manipulating people like FDR.
Overall, what is your take on the Comfort Orwell exchange?
It was something I knew a bit about because I'd written this book on Orwell. And I just bring out a few points that people might overlook. I don't have a kind of a millenarian Armageddon type conclusion about it. I just think it's an interesting aspect of this anarcho-pacifism and Orwell's sort of left-wing pro-war position.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fascinating, especially for people who like Orwell for obvious reasons. For people who aren't as familiar with him, is it true to say that even though the experience like in Catalonia and so forth like made him anti-communist, was he always socialist till the end, Orwell?
Yes, he didn't. There's no evidence that every little scrap that Orwell wrote that has been recovered is collected in the 20 volumes of his complete works. The first 9 volumes are his 9 book-length works, and the other 11 volumes are very fat. They're each very fat. there is, I've been over every line several times, and there is no evidence that he ever had, that, you know, he took this position that, that not only was, see, he took the position that collectivism, the abolition of capitalism, was inevitable and unstoppable, and no, and it wasn't a matter for choice. And so he hoped that he could make the coming collectivism more democratic and more liberal, as he put it. But he occasionally expressed doubts about whether that was possible. And he just said, well, it's maybe the abolition of capitalism means the abolition of liberty, you know. So, yes, he but there's right up to the end of his life, you know, he wrote 1984. It came out in 1949. He died in January 1950. The last 12 months of his life, or a little bit more, he was a very sick person in a sanitarium. And he could talk intelligently and reply to letters and things like that, but he couldn't undertake. In fact, the staff of the hospital took his typewriter away so that he wouldn't be tempted to get into any strenuous work. So he was just basically dying in that period. Partly because of an injury, a long-term consequence of an injury he'd received in Spain, where a bullet went through his throat, and he survived, believe it or not, which is an incredible thing to happen. Yeah. It just missed everything that was truly vital and went through the front of his throat and out the back of his neck. He managed to survive that, although he was hospitalized for a while. There is no indication that he doubted this fixed view that capitalism was doomed. And the interesting thing, well, one, there are many interesting things about this. One is that Orwell knew absolutely nothing about subjects like economics and industrial organization. Absolutely nothing. and yet it was on the basis of what had supposedly been demonstrated by these disciplines, economics and industrial organization, that he felt sure, because all the people, when he went to like Fabian weekend schools and things like that, Fabian Society weekend schools, though, all these leftist things that he took part in, all these very well-qualified economists were saying capitalism can't survive. It's in its death agony. It's in its last throes. The only possible future is collectivism, and it's just like people today. They hear people who pose as climate scientists say that the world is threatened by global warming, or as they like to call it now, climate change, and they believe it. They believe this bloody nonsense, and Orwell's like this. He's an intellectual who accepts certain things that all intellectuals, correct thinking intellectuals in his day, believed in. You'd think, one thing was, of course, that from his point of view, Britain won the war despite not having a socialist revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might expect him to say, oh, that's just because Russia and America came in. But he didn't say that. After Russia and America were both in the war, he still kept saying we need a socialist revolution. So I think he didn't fully appreciate the extent to which the Soviet Union was responsible for defeating Hitler. I think he thought it was mostly Britain with a bit of help from the Americans. Orwell's conviction that capitalism, when it was in its last throes, whatever else you might think, that was certainly a false conviction, right? Even if you hate capitalism, you have to agree that it wasn't in its last throes in the 1940s. So his conviction, his unshakable conviction that this was a truth that could be relied upon, it just illustrates how intellectuals take their bearings from whatever is the scuttlebutt of the persuaders of the moment, you know.
Right, right.
And it should make you much more critical about things you hear that everybody supposedly agrees with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to ask now, since you're such an expert on Orwell, and a few years ago, my son, when he was still in high school, had to read Animal Farm. And so I reread it with him. And I was just blown away by how much wisdom was packed. Like, what a great, what a brilliant story that was. So my question to you is, and I would encourage for, you know, listeners, like if you read it when you were younger, read it again. I think you're going to be surprised at, you know, how much is in there that you probably missed when you, if you read it in high school or something, because you didn't know anything about the world. Right. So David, I'm wondering, suppose he had never written 1984, would we know him? Would he be a famous person now because of Animal Farm, or would that, was that not enough, do you think?
Yeah, I think he'd be a lot less famous, but he'd still be, that's a note of, I mean, Animal Farm is absolutely brilliant. Actually, this brilliance is lost on a lot of people today because they don't know the Russian revolutionary counterparts of what they're reading. You know,
right?
That when it says, "Oh, this faction of the pigs was in favor of the windmill, and then this other faction was against it, and then the faction, exactly the Stalinist faction, came around and supported the windmill." You know, that is the whole question of. Whether the Soviet Union isolated and without foreign supporters should engage upon rapid industrialization, and it's very much tracks exactly what happened. You know, this is, very few of the things in the book are totally accidental. They're mostly very strictly related, you know, Orwell even went back and changed little details because they didn't correspond. They weren't totally parallel to what had actually happened in Russia. So it's absolutely remarkable in that sense.
Hey, hang on. You mean he wrote Animal Farm and there were like implicitly some predictions, and then he went back and tweaked Animal Farm based on what the
What I mean is, for example. There was something in the original draft of Animal Farm where he said all the pigs fell on their faces or something like this. Don't hold me to the exact right,
sure.
All the pigs fell on their faces, and it was at some display of overpowering force by the humans or something like that. And he went back and changed it to all the pigs except Napoleon. Because he was struck by Stalin's courage at the time of the siege of Leningrad. It was a very particular thing to make it correspond with what he thought had actually happened.
Maybe I meant when you said he went back and changed, you didn't mean after a publication. You meant working on it.
This was all pre-pub.
That's where my confusion was. Okay, great. Can we quickly touch on one more? Do you got to go? Because this is
for the next 24 hours.
Okay, we probably won't need to go that long. But okay, yeah, I did want to cover your essay 7 here. The title is Dr. Peterson! ! Clean up your theory! ! Why don't I stop there and let you speak a bit on that. There was a particular thing I want to zoom in on, but
it's actually a long time since I looked at that. Let me think. Yeah, there used to be a guy called Jordan Peterson who was somewhat famous.
Yeah.
Is
the clean up your theory like a riff on clean up your room?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's what. Yes, clean up your room was the thing that made him famous.
Well, here, let me read the thing I want you to, because it give you a little more.
Go on. Yeah.
Okay, so you're going through this and you talk about it, and then at one point you say, Peterson has stated that he didn't understand the story of Adam and Eve until he read Paradise Lost. This remark reveals a couple of things about Peterson's presuppositions. So I'll just read a little bit for the listeners and also to jog your memory. So first, it assumes that the story of Adam and Eve had one specific meaning, which is other than that it actually happened. Peterson agrees that it didn't. And second, this meaning must be difficult to identify. It must be non-evident to the ordinary reader, since Peterson, like most of us, has been familiar with the story since childhood and didn't know its meaning until he read Paradise Lost. And thirdly, the meaning Peterson has now arrived at is not something in the mind of the original author or of the compiler who decided to include this tall tale in Genesis, or of any of the thousands of people who learned and studied the story for many centuries after that. We know this because the cosmology and theology of John Milton, the English Puritan who wrote Paradise Lost in 1667, are violently at odds with the cosmology and theology of the writers and compiler of the Torah and of the Torah's devotees, especially pre-exile devotees. So a lot there. Do you want to discuss?
When Christians look at the Old Testament, they often see things in it which Jews don't see. Mm-hmm.
We see paradise, Jesus everywhere. Hey, that's Jesus. That's Jesus. We're talking about Jesus.
apart from that, the God of the Old Testament is a God who created good and evil, mm-hmm. consciously and deliberately. The Christian God, influenced, I think, by Zoroastrianism, is a dualist. There is God, who is good, and there is the devil, who is evil. And the devil, they take a verse in Isaiah, which doesn't have anything to do with a rebel angel, and they turn it into a statement about that Christians do about a rebel angel. So it's this idea of Lucifer, which is actually, this is about the replacement of the Second Babylonian Empire by the Persian Empire. It's got nothing to do with a rebel angel. The Christians translate it into Latin, Lucifer, which means light bringer. And so you get this whole Christian idea of the devil, who is the prince of evil and has millions of demons at his command. And that's something that's very alien to Judaism. One thing that's noticeable, I had a Christian upbringing became very familiar with the New Testament and slightly familiar with the Old Testament. And one thing that's very noticeable is that if you read the Gospels, the four canonical Gospels, they're full of stuff about demons, evil demons, possessing yep. people. Mm-hmm. You don't find this in the Old Testament. You just don't find it. It's around every corner,
Yeah, right.
Every street corner has, you walk around it and there's another demon doing stuff. And Christians have this idea of the devil. And this is really alien to Judaism. Judaism Satan, and Satan is someone in the Old Testament who always does what God tells him to do. Always. The most extreme evidence of this is in the book of Job.
Right.
Where God and Satan have some sort of cordial conversations about the best way to test this guy Job and see whether he really will stick to the Lord, even if everything goes wrong for him. Satan in the Old Testament is someone totally subject to God's will and God's orders. When you look at something like the story of Adam and Eve, Christians read into that all kinds of things which Jews wouldn't. So that was the point I was getting at there. Now, coming back to Jordan Peterson, I'm dealing with the early Jordan Peterson, early in the sense of immediately after he became famous, because mm-hmm. that chapter is actually a previously published article that's a few years old. So what was Jordan Peterson telling the world? Well, he was going around the world, actually. That's not an exaggeration. He was surfing this amazing fame. He was on the road with Dave Rubin and had hugely packed auditoriums. And what he would do is he would engage in a remarkable performance, often lasting well over 2 hours, where he would take a story, most often a biblical story, and he would talk about this story with lots of digressions, which helped to bulk up the 2 hours, right? Mm-hmm. But still, and so he would explain what these stories meant. So Peterson put forward the idea there are these stories that may be familiar to us, or that even if they're not familiar to us, they're easily available and we can read them. And we can learn a lot from these stories. And what I'm trying to show, in that article, I show that Peterson's ideas, as they were in those few years, right, are totally ignorant and unsupported by any real knowledge of the subjects he's talking about. Certainly all his views on prehistory and things like that are very uninformed. And he doesn't know much about philosophy. But he talks as though he does. So he's got this, and it's a Jungian idea. He thought that Jung's theory of archetypes was vital, although exactly why it's vital is a bit of a mystery. I think there's a bit of a mystery there because Jung had this idea that there are archetypes, or in other words, patterns, which recur in all cultures. And it's very important to Jung that these are not cultural products. They're inherent in human beings. It's part of what Jung called the collective unconscious, and it exists genetically. Although that's not the term that Jung usually used, but that's what he clearly meant to imply. So we can unlock secrets unconscious mental development. So one of the things you have to understand about me is I'm a skeptic about the unconscious, whether Freudian or Jungian, right? But we can unlock these secrets, and we can do it by decoding these traditional stories, which most of the stories that Peterson uses are Bible stories. And I argue a number of things. One is that what Peterson ends up doing is not knowing much about the actual historical context of these stories, right? He just comes up with an interpretation. So these stories for Peterson are a Rorschach test. They tell us what Peterson would like to believe and nothing else. They don't tell you anything about the stories. And they don't unlock a key which is going to help you solve problems in your personal life and enable you to clean up your room. So this is part of what I'm doing in that bit about the stories. Let me give an example which I think is very telling. It's an untypical example because this is usually Peterson just sticks to, he says, this is the correct interpretation of this story. If you were to say, well, this is one way of looking at it, that his whole argument would lose its force, right? He has to say there's something correct about this interpretation. There is a famous Bible story where, commemorated by Bob Dylan, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Is the opening line? Highway 61 revisited, I think. God tells Abraham to get ready to sacrifice his son. That would be Isaac, I suppose. And God, being an obedient servant of God, Abraham. Gets ready, and he actually gets a knife and gets some wood to make the, because he's going to turn his son into a burnt offering. Mm-hmm. He gets ready to kill his son. Immanuel Kant said about this that Abraham could never be sure that the voice he heard was that of God, but he could be sure that what he was being asked to do was immoral and he shouldn't do it. That was Kant, I tend to agree with that, both parts of it. At the last minute, God appears, or the angel of the Lord appears to Abraham and says, "No, don't do it." Mm-hmm. There is that ram over there, and there's a ram that's caught in a thicket, and so you can sacrifice that as a burnt offering instead of your son, right? Peterson has, in two separate places, he has two totally different interpretations of this story, which is unusual. Usually there's just one interpretation in Peterson, and that's it. But one interpretation he has, and it's the best known, is that it was very difficult for early human beings to understand how to make sacrifices for the sake of a future benefit. Mm-hmm. And this was a way of bringing home to people, this story is a way of bringing home to people the truth that you have to make sacrifices if there's a correspondingly future benefit. As I point out, you know, that it's a question of time preference, but I don't think Peterson was up on Bernbeverk or anybody like that. So anyway.
Well, he is now because he had me on his show.
Yeah, oh, right. Probably now. By now, he's trying to fix some of the gaps in his knowledge. But my point is simply this: I don't believe there was a person called Abraham, but let's suppose there was. That would be about 2000 BC, and Abraham, according to the story, came from Ur of the Chaldees, right? According to what it says. So what we would now call Ur 3, I think. So Mesopotamian civilization, thousands of years before that, had checking accounts, mortgages, negotiable debt instruments. It had an elaborate financial system in the civilization we call the Sumerian civilization. So the whole so Peterson has this idea that people were just non-rational and non-acquainted with rational calculation and things like that until very recently in human history. In fact, he says until the 17th century, which is totally ridiculous. But anyway, one aspect of it being totally ridiculous is that Mesopotamian civilization, which it supposedly gave birth to Abraham, was just as familiar with financial dealings as today's floor traders. They wouldn't have had the slightest difficulty in understanding making an investment now for a future return. That's just ridiculous. So
that's, or even just knowing like not to eat the seed corn. Like if you're an agricultural society.
Right. Well, there is that. Yeah, it starts from very basic things like that. Yes. You know, there is also this related point that Peterson says people had no concept of objective truth until the 17th century. So,
I've never heard him. He said that.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. He said. Yes. He says that it's in his first book, which I've what's it called now? I forget. His first
is that
book,
Maps of Meaning.
Yes, that's it. Maps of Meaning. Yes, he says that because he has this idea that in the early, right up until modern times, and well into modern times, people were governed by myths and didn't have a sort of rational argument. And, you know, I mean, I don't need to tell you, but for the benefit of any Peterson fans who are listening, there were the medieval philosophers, you know, Aquinas and people like that, Occam, Duns Scotus. They had a very good grasp of objective reality and objective truth and objective arguments. And then before them, of course, you had Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics. They, too, had an excellent grasp. Much better than today's postmodernists, I would say, of objective reality. And then you can go back to the pre-Socratics, who some of whom were actually materialists who said there are nothing but atoms and the void, were constantly thinking about the sort of objective reality. So, but this is just how totally wrong-headed Peterson's view of the world was at that time. You know, that he thought that, that there was this, that for nearly all of human existence, people couldn't perform rational calculations, and they were just the slaves of myths. Their myths were what guided their thinking. And actually, I point out in that little chapter that myths presuppose knowledge of objective reality. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't understand the myth of who's the guy who flew up to the sun?
Icarus?
Icarus. You couldn't understand the myth of Icarus unless you knew something about things melting, things falling, just the sun being hot. All these objective facts about the world. You have to understand them before you can make any sense of the story of Icarus. His view of the Peterson's view of the world is just hopeless and terribly. Terribly uninformed. I should say, by the way, that in that I was picking on certain aspects of Peterson's thinking in that particular chapter. And actually, you might find this hard to credit. I actually think Peterson talks a lot of sense a lot of the time, and basically what he says about. Wokeism coming from postmodern neo-Marxism, for example, I think is spot on. He's got that right, and there are all kinds of other things that he has correct, but they weren't the topic of that chapter I wrote. So right. I was really going after him at his weakest points.
Okay, out of curiosity, just to understand, I mean, presumably Jordan Peterson thinks that Euclidean proofs and whatever. They understood like, a valid proof or not. But are you saying it's like, let me just give you examples. I've heard some Christians, when somebody will ask them like, what about, the Genesis? Like, how can you believe this stuff? The Genesis account. And I've heard some Christians say, back then in that culture, when they wrote down like origin myths and whatever, like they didn't think they were doing a history book the way we think of it today. Like, so they weren't lying. Like, so is that the kind of thing that you're saying that Peterson is attributing to them? Like to say, it's not that they thought 2 + 2 could equal anything you want, but more like to them, the distinction we're making between myth and history to somebody Peterson's claiming from 2000 BC, that distinction wouldn't be as crisp.
Well, I'll have to remember that next time I make a deposition.
Okay. no, but you see what I'm, you understand what I'm asking? No, are you saying that's what you are saying his view is, as opposed to like Galileo understood what objective truth was, presumably, like the concept?
I mean, I think, I'm not sure whether that captures everything that he got wrong. But I do think, that it's characteristics of Peterson in the Maps of Meaning book and then the other two books that became bestsellers, that he lays down the law about subjects that he really is pretty ill-informed about. And actually, did you look at the last chapter in the book?
This one? No. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I didn't get a chance to get to it.
Well, in the last chapter, the beginning of the last chapter, I make this connection between Ayn Rand and Jordan Peterson. Okay. The Ayn Rand movement of the 1960s has many points of contact with the Jordan Peterson movement 50 years later. Both movements appealed to young men, although the Peterson young men were a little bit older than the Randian young men. Both of them became viewed as right wing. Both of them had this kind of all-encompassing theory of practical life and philosophy, and so on and so forth. Both Ayn Rand and Jordan Peterson were ignoramuses who laid down the law about things they really knew nothing about. And I take it from there. And the connection, of course, one of the that leads on to that chapter. Is that there is this philosopher called Stephen Hicks, and he is a bridge between the Ayn Rand movement and the and the Jordan Peterson movement, because he is a very devout, shall we say, Randist, who made the acquaintance of Jordan Peterson, and they apparently got on. I think it was because they both basically both disliked postmodernism, which right, I agree right. with them. Mm-hmm. I agree with them. I mean, you know, I don't like postmodernism either. And so as a result of Jordan Peterson's imprimatur, Hicks's book on postmodernism has sold extremely well. As you might expect, Hicks's book is all about how all the evils of the world are due to Immanuel Kant. So that last chapter is about all the things that that Hicks gets wrong about Immanuel Kant, and how, in fact, Immanuel Kant was a libertarian or a classical liberal and didn't hold any of the crazy views that Hicks attributes to him.
So just as a point of reference for the listeners, so Stephen Hicks that you're talking about, I think, is the same guy that debated Thaddeus Russell at a Soho Forum debate about postmodernism, that Thaddeus Russell has been saying.
I didn't see that, actually. Yeah, but I can imagine it. I can imagine it. Yes.
But you're saying Hicks is a Randian?
Yes.
You're saying that, Stephen, huh, that I wouldn't have guessed that. I guess that surprised me. I'll have to go look into that.
Totally devout Randian. I mean, his book is called Explaining Postmodernism, is the title of his book, is pure Ayn Rand. I don't think he did, it's presented as such, you know. I mean, I'm not saying anything.
So I guess he's coming from, hey, if A is A, then that's why postmodernism is stupid, like, to boil it like
that.
It's more than that. That would take one sentence.
There's a lot more than that. I mean, the thing is, I personally don't have much sympathy with postmodernism. postmodernism is a very variegated thing, and it doesn't do to put all postmodernists in the same category. I would say that someone who's into Michel Foucault needs help, and someone who's into Jacques Lacan is beyond help. That would be my view. Peterson has this idea that postmodernism is the culmination of Kant, and he thinks that because Ayn Rand told him that everything that's bad about the modern world is the culmination of Kant. Right?
Okay.
So basically, there are two things that the main thing is that Hicks is hung up on is the notion that Kant said that we can't know reality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kant didn't say that we can't know reality. That's just an elementary mistake about Kant. And I can tell you what Kant did, if anybody's interested, I can tell you what Kant did think, including areas where there is some controversy about what Kant thought. So the other thing would be that Kant is supposed, and this applies to all these Randists, that Kant believed in self-sacrifice as a moral good, you know, because Rand thought that that the ultimate moral precept was self-interest, and so the most evil thing you could be was a believer in self-sacrifice, which is the opposite of self-interest. One of the curious things about these Randists is that they assume that if someone doesn't agree that the key to morality is self-interest, they must think that the key to morality is self-sacrifice. Well, of course, the vast majority of ethical theorists and philosophers of ethics have not thought either of those things. They've thought that self-interest, there has to be self-interest, it's essential, but that sometimes it's better to go against, it's more morally appropriate to go against self-interest. So that's what that last chapter is all about.
Okay. Well, I think in the interest of time here, we should stop on that note. So I feel like I should officially say, like, I like Jordan Peterson, but I have not, grappled with your criticisms of him. And so, I
I definitely agree. I've seen him talk about certain biblical stories where I thought he already had his psychological framework in mind and then just deployed it on that story when, you know, so some, like, when I think it hits, I think it's fascinating, but there are other times when I agree, it looks like he's trying to put a, you know, round peg into a square hole, you know, as they say. So I can see that phenomenon you're talking about. Okay, well, the book is The Conquistador with His Pants Down, David Ramsey Steele's Legendary Lost Lectures. So Dave, people, oh, you got it right there for the video. Great. And I imagine you can get this at, you know, Amazon and anywhere fine books are sold.
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, great. So, David, thanks so much for your time and your insights. Okay. And thank you. Always a fascinating discussion.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Thanks.
Sure thing. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. See you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.